Hi, everybody. This is Mike Oppenheim, and you are listening to Coffin Talk, Interviews with the Living, a weekly podcast that explores how our views on death affect the way we live our life. This week, we have a very special guest coming to the show. He is a representative for an organization that I've absolutely fallen in love with, NDERF.org. He's going to open up and talk about near-death experiences and what the organization does and how it operates. With no further delays, Mr. Joseph Cascio, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mike. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so excited to ask you a lot of questions, and I know that time is hard for you to come by because you do so many things and you also work full-time in addition to working with this organization. So we will skip some of our preliminary questions, and I will just first off ask you to explain the acronym NDERF and how you got associated with them.
Yeah, NDERF is the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. It is an organization that was initially founded by Dr. Jeffrey Long, who was a radiation oncologist and came across his first NDE, well over 20, probably 25 years ago now, and began to be intrigued. Of course, the implications of NDEs are absolutely incredible to our understanding of the world and our place in it. So he set up a website, NDERF.org, NDERF.org, and started collecting people's NDEs from all around the world. And currently we have, as far as I am aware of, the largest publicly available database of NDEs, vetted NDEs, in the sense that they do have to go through a very involved survey in addition to the narrative, online and available to the public.
Awesome. And I have to ask it just because it's required. Did you believe in NDEs before you became associated with the group? And do you still believe in them?
Yeah, well, I had a bit of an experience myself many, many years ago. And one of the reasons that I got connected with NDEs and NDERF in particular is because when I ran across the website and started reading the accounts online, I felt very connected to them. My experience was not an NDE per se. It was a spiritually transformative experience, something called STEs. Mm. But that is sort of the larger umbrella by which NDEs fall under, and really many other phenomenon. But this particular experience is one of great value in the scientific world because it can be studied under very controlled circumstances, or elements of them can be studied.
Awesome. And so if a person listening to the show wanted to, can they go to NDERF.org and then read accounts? Like, is it just a database for any person?
Yeah, of course. You can not only that, you can even search accounts. And I do agree here that the goal is not to read any one NDE. I think the greater truth of the experience comes out in reading many of them. There are varied aspects and various experiences in terms of the depth of the experience. And so by going online and looking at them, you can get sort of a flavor of all types of them. And, you know, they usually are accompanied by a very serious trauma. And that sort of adds information about the state of people's mind physically and mentally during the NDE, and helps give us that control structure within the scientific arena to be able to assess them.
Awesome. And so I guess speaking of the scientific arena, what is the definition of an NDE that NDERF.org adheres to, if any?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because I think it was a difficult one to come about. And I think as we speak, we're seeing the definition kind of update itself and become a little bit clearer to the scientists who are researching it. I think more recently, the NDE term is just not as appreciated as much as people who are actually clinically dead. And so they're redefining it as experiences of death.
Oh.
But the way it's commonly understood and the way Dr. Long has defined it is that it's a lucid experience associated with perceived consciousness apart from the body, occurring at a time of actual or imminent threatened death, or threatened imminent death.
Wow.
So the idea of lucidity, yeah, it does seem striking, right?
Yes.
It's a bit of a paradox that you would have a lucid experience with perceived consciousness apart from the body that's occurring at a time of actual or imminent clinical death.
I want to ask a lot of questions based on like what the aggregate answer would be, and I'm pretty certain that's impossible. So forgive me with like the clumsy phrasing of these questions, but I'll leave it up to you to kind of work with my language barriers. How many people who have an NDE, like, is it common that when they come out of it, they feel like their life has changed, or is that just my perception from reading books about it?
Yeah, no, it is a life-changing phenomenon and experience, one unlike any other in the human lexicon of experiences, you might say. And that's what's also another sort of evidential fact as to their reality. Certainly, there's so many that I could choose from, but I think some of the ones of great interest is, and one that I can sort of speak to myself after my experience, is a complete or significant reduction in the fear of death. I would say it's pretty much a complete elimination of the fear of death. However, the actual part of physical death is something that I think most people can be, you know, worried about or afraid of. But the idea that it's an extinguishing of self-consciousness is something that has now been scientifically proven not to be true.
Mm, wow.
That's a bold statement. That's a bold statement. I understand that. I think, you know, that's one of the things that our organization is trying to do by the aggregation of these experiences and dissemination of them in aggregate, and the scientific research that, you know, people can research and look into. It speaks very powerfully to that fact. And I've seen some high-placed conversations with some very intelligent people kind of come to the wire on this topic and what it really means. So there's basically two camps that you have, and that is the camp that believes that NDEs are fully and wholly a brain-induced phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there is the evidence that I think is clearly showing that it is not wholly a brain-induced phenomenon, mm-hmm. and one that is actually speaking to the separation of self-consciousness from the physical body.
Wow, that's fascinating. I remember reading once that the chemical compound, which is familiarly known as DMT, is in a child's brain at birth and often recorded in a patient's brain when they die. So I guess first, before I ask the second part of this question, have you ever heard of that? Is that something you're familiar with?
And not in the context you've stated it, but a lot of people have associated DMT with NDE-like experiences.
Yeah, and so that's kind of where I was going, was I was curious if, I'm trying to think how to really phrase this concisely. Both those arguments hold water to any rational thinking human, and I lean towards one because of a subjective opinion and a likability to it. What is like a factor you would say from the immense research that NDERF has collected that would lean someone who's in the middle, so not like a pure skeptic, but just someone who's kind of on the fence towards the side that isn't saying this is a chemically induced experience in the brain?
Yeah, I think the silver bullet lies in the element of the out-of-body experience.
Ah.
So the idea of the definition saying that there's perceived consciousness apart from the body, again, these are bold statements. And so how do you scientifically prove that? Or what is the falsifiable sort of experimental state that you can create to help prove that fact? And with NDEs, it's quite easy. There are people who are undergoing, you know, severe trauma, physical trauma, and or clinical death, who claim that they saw things happening in the operating room or in other locations from where their body was at that basically correspond, not basically, but actually corresponds to reality.
Ah.
And therein lies the most important evidence. And, you know, and the part that intrigues me is when I put up those, the research and the accounts that have independent verification of these out-of-body observations and perceptions, it's hard to get people to really just kind of answer that question. That is the strongest argument by far to the evidence that demonstrates the separable nature of self-consciousness from the physical body. You cannot have, under any brain-induced substance or phenomenon, a observation audially or visually that corresponds to reality, and that happens at a point in time and from a position that is inconsistent with the state and location of the body. You can't be outside of your body at a time that you're comatose on an operating table or, you know, in a trauma situation, and make observations adamantly saying that you saw it with a sense of certitude and reality that you would in any other eyewitness event, and have those observations correspond to reality. When you're sitting there, you know, eyes closed, physically compromised and or clinically dead. I mean, that really is what it comes down to. There's so much more to that. But I think if you really just want to talk to somebody heart to heart and say, you know, please help, you know, give me a hypothesis that, you know, that kind of conveys, I don't know any other hypothesis or conclusion that you can come to when you present that evidence other than actual veridical perceptions outside of the body.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm reminded of like the idea that there were such things as germs in the air preceded the invention of a microscope that could identify it. So we're always, when it comes to like what, you know, people jokingly refer to as woo-woo science, it's only woo-woo until a measurable instrument is developed. So I actually think this segues into my next question, which is there is a project that's pretty famous in mainstream culture now called Neuralink, and it just had some exciting news in the last few weeks, which is that they were able to get someone who can't like use their body to with their mind picture something, and then it was able to be like transferred and done on a computer. Other people think that Neuralink is going to lead to what we would call mind reading, but basically the ability to speak and communicate, speak is the wrong word, communicate telepathically. Do you think that that technology is kind of like buttressing and approaching what NDEs are kind of saying about existence?
I can't speak to Neuralink specifically, but I think the one of the fascinating areas that I really like to focus on when looking at and studying NDEs is this idea of the individual human thought. I mean, each of us probably have dozens, if not hundreds of thoughts a day. Multiply that by billions of people around the world, and you have like trillions of thoughts potentially happening every day. And there is not a single human thought that can yet be proven to exist. I think it's a fascinating sort of derivative of the mind-body problem or the hard problem of consciousness. I think that is also speaking to the very clear answer that NDEs tell us, and that is when they have an experience, they're indicating that they, their self-consciousness, the way they think mostly as they do in the physical body, remains intact when they are making these out-of-body observations, and they're pretty much wholly themselves, except with added perceptual abilities. And I think that's fascinating, because it would seem then that, you know, your thoughts are what survive physical death. And, you know, what does that tell us about the nature of thoughts or the substance of thoughts, if you will? So I think that can go into a discussion, and it's, you know, less supported by the evidence, but certainly a direct, I think, deduction from the experience itself.
Yeah.
If NDEs, so here's the way I like to think about it. If NDEs are representing a state of existence that is outside the physical body in some realm, you know, that we call spiritual dimensions or higher dimensions, whatever your term, your preferred term is, it is certainly reflecting a level of technology that is so far beyond understanding that it just, I don't know, confounds the most intelligent people on the planet. Because when you're there outside of your body and you're seeing yourself or the world, I think the first, you know, when you really think about it deeply, the first thought that has to be kind of addressed is, hey, I was in that body for X amount of years or decades before this crisis or trauma, and I didn't know I had a self-consciousness that could separate from my body. Let me call it the soul, because it's the easiest term that I think. And think about, so then therefore this body must be a vehicle that housed my soul and housed it so perfectly that I couldn't even tell that I was a vehicle housed within, my soul was housed in this vehicle, the body. And therefore there must be a vehicle builder, and you get to this creator God concept and other elements or, you know, discussions and NDEs. But if you really think about it, you look back and you say, wow, this body, which we think, I think, is one of the most, you know, fascinating, incredible creations there is. I mean, it's just an absolutely complex, just beautiful thing that we're still trying to figure out. And yet, I'm not my body. And what kind of technology can do that? So if I speak in technological terms, and therefore, if the spiritual world or the higher dimension or whatever it is they're viewing from, right? Because they're looking at the world and the world can't see them. That's one of the obvious things about out-of-body perceptions. Mm-hmm. And so that speaks to like a higher dimension or something along those lines, because dimensional constructs and science and mathematics specifically can help explain it. You know, all you have to do is bring the dimensional level down to two dimensions and you can start talking about how three dimensions relate to two dimensions. Most people can understand that. And that gives you some sense of the abilities and that higher dimensions would have upon our three-dimensional space. And so coming back to your question, what does that mean for, you know, being able to read minds? Well, I think that's a given, because one of the other evidences that I think is very powerful in the near-death experience, which is consistently reported, in fact, I would say most consistently reported, proportional to the depths of the experience, the means of communication is almost always reported as thought-to-thought communication. That's a powerful statement because we don't, as human beings, you know, day-to-day walk around having thought-to-thought communications. In fact, it never happens. Mm-hmm. We always have to convey our thoughts verbally through the sound waves, right, in our voices, or through light waves as we write something down on a piece of paper or on an electronic device and send it to someone. So the idea of thought-to-thought communication without a medium by which to express those thoughts doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So why then would the vast majority of people who come back from a deep near-death experience say, oh yeah, communication was thought-to-thought, or, you know, something along those lines?
Fantastic answer. And again, thank you. Obviously, Einstein changed culture when he convinced everyone that time and space are perhaps not as connected as people wanted to think. And I would imagine these NDEs are obviously pointing to a similar concept of temporality, because if a person is in a coma and then having an ability, or, you know, any traumatic experience, and like it's a matter of seconds, but then they can elaborate about a scene or a situation that took longer and happened at the same time, it would beg us to think even further about temporality. So I'm curious, specifically with the people, with the stories you've collected and reviewed, do people ever have trouble like reconnecting to like being a normal human after these things? Like, do they have issues with time, for example, or an issue with maybe like going back to work and just being a normal person like they were?
So the short answer is yes. And the fact of the matter is that many, and I would say most, again, proportional to the depth of the experience, that's a phrase I like to use quite a bit. No one really wants to come back. And if you find yourself in a state of existence where you have enhanced consciousness, enhanced abilities, freedom, faster movement, more visual field of view, or, you know, how that's one of the things that's mentioned, how could you want to come back to a state of existence where you're so restrained? I tell people, look, imagine you're walking around with a wetsuit. Imagine the whole world, 8 billion people, we're all wearing wetsuits. We got these thick, like, you know, rubbery kind of skins, and we got sort of the diver's mask on, restricting our field of view. We've got these flippers that are, you know, just impeding our ability to move around. And we're all sitting, but the whole world lives like this. So you wouldn't think any different. Oh, there's, you know, so-and-so and his big flippers, and so-and-so with her small flippers. And everyone's kind of talking about their state of existence. Now, imagine for a moment that the wetsuit comes off, the diving mask is removed, the field of vision is greatly improved. You can feel sunlight on your skin, a sensation you've never been able to feel before. You have no flippers and you're speed of movement is dramatically faster than it was prior. This is a beautiful thing that's happening to you. And now all of a sudden you're told, or you are returned to your body and you're back in this. How can anyone want to get back and live in a wetsuit? So, I mean, that I think is a real easy way to think about the contrast of why, you know, it's so difficult for people to come back. And then of course, to readjust in that, okay, I'm back in my wetsuit. I'm back in my physical body. Now they have purpose. They understand there's purpose to it. Obviously, meaning and purpose is hard to come by in a purely secular, you know, atheistic frame of reference. It's not to say it can't happen, but the scope of that consciousness that you know you're being sort of watch, that you have a purpose greater than this world itself, now takes a lot of integration, not to mention the physical rehabilitation you have to, you know, go through to just get back to normal after your trauma, you know, or as normal as you can be. So there's a lot going on. And Dr. Long has always said, or at least I last heard him say that, you know, the integration period probably takes around 7 years to really kind of frame and understand what happened to you in a way that,
wow,
kind of, yeah, that allows you to walk through life with a sense of kind of meaning and purpose that, you know, has the two combined and bridges some of those conflicts or most of those conflicts.
Wow, that's so interesting. In your experience and in the research, are there any cultures or groups, language groups on Earth or religions that believe in NDEs and teach it to children and it's just like a regular part of their culture?
Boy, I wish there were. I know I'm starting to teach my son about near-death experiences from a very early age. Again, I think the understanding of them, it changes the conversation. The implications of what this, so if once you come to the conclusion that, oh, these out-of-body observations are true, they do correspond to reality, there's no other reasonable explanation than that your soul or self-consciousness survives bodily or physical death, which opens a whole can of other worms with other questions. And, you know, we're only scratching the tip of the iceberg. I don't know of any. However, there are clues and consistencies within all kinds of belief systems that point to that. I personally, when I was a hard-nosed atheist when my experience happened, and I came back and I was not a friendly person towards people of faith. And I, you know, was fairly certain in my stance and position. And I came back to really kind of understand and say, wow, can this stuff be true? I was raised in a Catholic household, and I sort of went back and started looking into the history of, you know, what makes up that theological belief system. I actually went to just about every major belief system to try to unravel what their core beliefs are and how they relate, obviously, at this point, to near-death experiences and my understanding of it. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of consistencies to be found. And I can go on, but I don't know how much time I have here. You know, that's a very important conversation, but none that I'm aware of.
You talked about the vast majority of these experiences that are on file say that they now have like a sense of purpose. And so in alignment with that, I've always felt like that's the most important thing to drive a human towards like flourishing. And I think if you feel like you have purpose, it doesn't matter if anyone else believes it or not. It gives you like a sense of determination, and it gives you a reason to wake up in the morning and a reason to care about things. So I'm curious if any of the research indicates that people feel like there's a sense of predetermination in existence.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. There was one experiencer, her name's Karen Thomas, and I've spoken to her on several occasions. She's helped me out quite a bit. She's one of the most articulate and has one of the, I think, most in-depth experiences we have in our database. If you look her up, it's Karen T at enderf.org. And so predetermination, it's an either or thing, I think, sometimes when it's discussed out there. It's either predetermined or not. I want to convey something to you that I think makes sense, that helps us understand this. So Karen was told in her experience that she would return. And there's certain things that she had a life review. Again, these are elements that I presume perhaps many or some of your listeners know of, but a life review is where you see your life replayed and you experience it through, I would say, a multi-conscious approach, or you experience it in first person. Again, it's kind of like you're reliving your life. This is what they tell us. Again, the vast majority, and I would I wish I had the statistics to say all of them, but there's the vast majority of deep NDE experiencers who have a life review will tell you that the life review occurred in a way where they not only were watching the experience, but they were reliving it in first person. In fact, they weren't not only reliving it in first person, but they were reliving it from the first person perspective of everyone else. And so this concept, again, not a human experience. So why are so many people talking about it or relating this? So it becomes evidential in that respect. But in Karen Thomas, in Karen's case, she came back and she was shown certain things about her future in her life review. And when she was returned, she was told that she was not going to be able to remember everything.
Oh, wow.
And that part of the reason was, I know, isn't it? It's mind blowing. I mean, and again, this, I think we're a little bit outside the scope. I think the evidence of what's being relayed by the experiencers is foundational, can be studied, and et cetera. But as we elaborate on this predetermination kind of question, It brings up the idea. She was told there are certain things that are going to happen irrespective of what you would do. And there are other things that your behavior or actions will influence what will happen. And so how do we think about that in a way to understand it? I think of a racetrack or a video game where you're playing a game and the program is going to get you to this endpoint. You are going to meet Darth Vader or whatever, you know. But there are several doors you can open and each one has an experience of its own. So there are various points in time, it would appear to me, that might be predetermined, but various things that are either answerly or critical to getting to that point that you may influence based on your behavior. So I believe it's a little more complicated than just saying, is it predetermined or not?
Yeah, I love that answer. And I mean, to me, it's always felt that way, like on an internal level. And also the more I've researched and read different philosophical treatises on this subject, the more it seems evident to me that it's very likely that two things are going on at once, that you have free will. Also, one other thing I've always thought about is if I have a prenatal existence in which I'm planning like my body and putting my soul, as you refer to it, which I like, into that body, then it's possible that I used free will to create a predetermined path. So that also gels with my mindset.
And if you are drawing out your path in life, and that's part of how it works, perhaps there are also parts in your life that have to be met.
Yeah.
Either because you drew them out or it was part of the collective whole or how it was influenced, and you have to go through it. And so I think that's kind of what the conclusion or what comes out of understanding what people are saying about, you know, predetermination versus, you know, free will, and how much free will do you actually have? You know, there's some wiggle room there. And I think it can easily be understood by this idea that the quickest way between two points is a straight line, but maybe there are different paths to get to that other point, and some might be more exciting than a straight line, you know? And so that's the various decisions we can make within this creation, this construct, however you want to describe physical life within the perception and the idea of a higher dimension.
Yeah, definitely. I have a couple questions left. I'm going to ask the pivotal question of the podcast now, just because I think it's a good moment to ask it, but I do have a few after this. So I am speaking to you, Joseph, and you represent an organization, but this question is for you specifically. When you die, based on the research that you're talking about, it seems that like you still die. Like a person who had a near-death experience didn't actually die. It was a near-death, but then they live to tell the tale. So what does, in your opinion, happen once you actually do die? Like, is the soul of Joseph going to live, but Joseph is never, ever, ever coming back? Or is it something in between?
Dr. Samparnia is one of the major researchers in this field. Had an interview with Robert Kuhn on Closer to Truth, who interviews many, many high-level scientists and physicists and cosmologists. And I think the direct answer, the scientific answer, is what he would say, I believe, and I think what I would try to answer your question is to say, yes, near-death experiences, I was talking about earlier, this difficulty with the definition. The near-death experience can happen to people who are near death, imminent death, comatose, still alive, with a heartbeat. And it can also happen to people who are clinically dead, whose hearts have stopped. And so Dr. Parnia is focusing on that group. His research, I think, is much more rigorous in that context. What we can say is the experiences of people who are clinically dead and the experiences of those who are near death are virtually identical. I see no difference whatsoever. And so this brings back the point. So, you know, there's nothing special about death. If the soul is separable, if self-consciousness is separable from the body, Nancy Rimes is another I think, fairly well-known near-death experiencer who indicated that, look, she was hit by a car riding on a bicycle. She remembers seeing herself from outside of her body looking down at the scene, and she remembers being in the body, and she called it dual consciousness. And again, the potential, the way we think about life is, you know, being in one place at one point in time, et cetera. It's the way we reason. It's the way it works. It's the way the physical, classical physics of the universe works. But then there's this thing called quantum theory that came around, quantum mechanics, and it turned everything we understood about physics sort of on its side, and we had to kind of reevaluate what it means. The greatest minds in the field say, we don't understand it, but we'll use the statistical outcomes and information to help construct our better construct our understanding of the universe. And what's happening is we're discovering that the nature of the universe is perhaps beyond our human ability to articulate. And that is an incredible revelation and a humbling one to the scientific effort. And I've heard high-placed scientists, I mean, Richard Feynman, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who was in the field of quantum mechanics, basically said, no one understands it. And if anyone says they understand it, they're just blatantly lying to you. Because even we don't understand it. And what he's trying to articulate, and so many people who are in quantum theory, and I would say in the sense in the NDE world, is that there's an ineffability about the experience. There are things that you can't articulate verbally. And so therefore, NDEs and death experiences, I think, are virtually identical. It is a nature of existence that is not wholly determined by your life, by being alive or being dead. And that might help explain spiritually transformative experiences as well. But it is certainly something that's giving us pause and allows us to really think deeply on these issues. When we have these discussions, I think people's heads will spin, some eyes will roll around. And if that's you, understand that's a lot of people who've had near-death experiences, or similar related experiences. That was me. And in an instant, with no input from any external physical source, my whole worldview turned on a dime. Everything I learned educationally, from culture, from family, from, life experiences, all of that turned on a dime by a moment that there's no words for. And that ineffability problem brings us back to, okay, how do I describe the color yellow to a blind person mm-hmm. who's never seen it? You can do your best, right? You're going to say, well, it's bright. It feels, sunshine on your skin. Okay, feel that. It's happy. It's warm. It's not cold water. It's not really hot, water. It's perfect. But you'll never come close to enabling that individual to understand the color yellow.
That's how I feel anytime I try to talk about peace to people who are interested in war. Like, it just seems like an unfathomable gap between these two. Like, and actually, this is kind of my next question. Based on the research and the vast majority of experiences, would you say that morality is subjective, objective, or neither?
Hey, everyone. If you're a fan of the show, please head over to MikeyOp.com and click the subscribe button. It's the best way to support us, and it's free. That's MikeyOp.com. Thanks.
I'll give you a twofold answer.
Okay.
I think morality I remember reading something about morality in relation to proximity to someone. Like, how does morality change relative to proximity? And this might help answer the question. If I am further away from you and I really don't know you, I can call you names with no real feeling of shame or whatever. I'm just giving an opinion. I could even be a nice guy and just not like you and just say that to my friends, whatever. But then when I'm with you, there's a sense of respect that I think most civil people will have, and you honor the person that's there. Tell me about your life and your career and kids. We may not agree, but I'm not going to make fun of you openly or harass you. At least I hope not. Yet when it comes to near-death experiences, there is one paramount word that keeps repeating itself upon people who have near-death experiences. And it's the sense of love in near-death experiences, but in a sense that it has substance. It's a level of love that can't be experienced in this world. And the closest thing that I think, when you look at all the experiences and people trying to relate to it, is they'll use terms like the perfect or ideal parental mother-father-to-child love. So it does seem like communication and proximity is helpful. If we know we tend to be kinder when we're closer to people, then perhaps that's something we need to keep in mind when we're further apart.
Wow, that was so profound and very well worded. It overshadows my next question, but it's kind of circling back to something you mentioned. A lot of people say it was like the most profound and great experience, and they felt this rich love, and they kind of like didn't want to come back. I remember Dr. Long talking about this on one of the podcasts I listened to with him, but I don't remember his answer, and I'd rather ask you. Do people ever beg to stay, and what is the answer, and what is like the consequences of like, okay, if you stay, but...
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't even say beg. I'd say they fight. They are aggressively fighting and resisting the return trip. And so it's really interesting. So, you know, there are a couple people, this is actually speaks to a bit of the nature of the experience that I think is difficult for people to really understand, although it really is directly speaking to the experience. A lot of people talk about the oneness of the afterlife, this feeling that I was connected to everything in the whole world and I knew everything and everything was made known to me. All I had to do was think about it. And sometimes I don't even have to think about it. And I just had this knowing. And yet people will be told they have to go back. Oftentimes when they have a resistance to it, or, you know, I know so many personal stories I can relate to, but just to kind of consolidate them into a single thought, there's an attempt sometimes of prodding people to go back. And then there's sometimes this big fight coming from the experiencer saying, there's no way I'm going back. You can't send me back there. How dare you show me this stuff and then, you know, send me back there, and sort of more of an attitude. And in either case, in all cases, of course, if we're hearing about it here on the physical world, they're back. And so in that sense, within the oneness, this wholeness, this oneness and unity of the afterlife existence or consciousness, there is still the separation of persons in the idea that you have an opinion and somebody else is telling you, no, you got to go back. And a hierarchy in the sense that that person can override your vigorous objection to returning and force you back. I mean, I'm using terms explicitly firm because that's the way it is. It's not like they're softly pushing you back. Sometimes it is. And if I suppose you choose to return, then it will be a softer issue. Or maybe you'll say, oh, I just had my daughter and this happened during my, you know, giving birth. And yeah, I do have a family to go back to, or they're shown family. It feels very much like a child being told, you got to go back to school. Well, Dad, I don't want to go back to school. You know, well, you know, there's so much to learn and they're so mean over there. They call me names. Yeah, I know. But you know what? They can't hurt you. Ultimately, you're coming home at the end. And that's something to remember.
Is there any sort of statistic on the type of trauma that is correlative to an NDE? And I'm specifically wondering if perhaps suicide ranks high on the list or not.
No, I don't know of any statistic. All kinds of traumas cause NDEs. Again, any actual, you know, or imminent life-threatening trauma or death, an NDE could occur. It's a spontaneous experience, really. At the end of the day, no one's really looking to have it. And, you know, you're very involved with your own body and the pain and the struggle of trying to survive. However, suicide is a very important discussion to have, because you're sitting here listening to all these people coming back and they're saying how beautiful this was and how glorious and just, oh my goodness, you know, and it's this bliss and state of, you know, nirvana or, you know, or heaven or whatever the term is. But at the end of the day, there are also distressing experiences. There are dark experiences. We don't like to talk about them. And people like to, in the world, say, oh, you know, well, suicide is going to, you know, land you in a dark place. And that's not necessarily true at all. And so I don't want to pin any type of trauma. Again, I'm not a researcher per se, I know that there's no specific level of trauma. No one knows the who's going to have an NDE, who's not going to have an NDE, mm-hmm. who's going to have a pleasant experience, which, by the way, is the vast majority of them, mm-hmm. and who's not going to have a pleasant experience. But one thing is known about suicides. The recurrence rate of suicides for those who have near-death experiences drops.
Wow.
Whereas suicide is a very, you know, it's not uncommon to reattempt a suicide.
Yeah, correct.
And that speaks to something powerfully, mm-hmm. to understand that, you know, I don't know how to put my finger on it exactly, but once you know that you are known, that you are loved, that you have purpose, it, in a sense, let me tell you something, in the words that I like to use, it devalues the state of this world, but not in a way where you want to escape it, in a way where you say, wow, look at this afterlife world that I was in, how beautiful it was. It turns this world into a place of fragility, a place that needs us. It needs humanity. It needs our love. And so we pour into it that love, and there's so much love being pushed into the world that all the bad stuff is coming out. And sometimes that is true, isn't it? Like, we see these bad things and it becomes pause for us to say, is this who we really are? Is this who we want to be?
Yeah. We are on the end of the interview. Is there anything you want our audience to know or think about?
Well, sure. It's important to say that, my comments here may not reflect the actual comments and perspectives of the Near Death Experience Research Foundation, or that specifically of Dr. Jeffrey Long. But at the end of the day, I am so grateful for the opportunity to be able to speak to you and to your audience. I mean, we really are trying to get people to come in and take a look at these experiences, and whatever level you're at. I find it difficult to believe that anyone can look at, read 50 or 100 of these experiences just randomly and not come away changed in some deep sense. And perhaps if we get closer to these experiences, we'll get closer to that state of peace that you were talking about earlier.
Well, wow. Thank you again. This has just been an incredible interview. I'm so thankful for you and for EndEarth.org. For everyone listening at home, there will be a link in the notes, but it's just EndEarth.org. Go over there and you can start exploring today, and hopefully it'll help you and create a sense of peace in your life, like Joseph was just explaining. And if you want to support the podcast, the best way to do that is to head over to MikeyOpp.com. That's MikeyOpp.com. And we have a weekly newsletter that releases that I write and also explain the podcast. And if you want to go the extra mile, we do have a premium package, which just helps us pay the bills. So thank you again, Joseph Casho, and thank you again to EndEarth.org. My name is Mike Oppenheim. You have been listening to Coffin Talk, and we will see you soon.